Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
It was, 10 days ago, maybe even not that long ago, we were talking with Carol Tobias, president of National Right to Life. The anniversary of Roe v. Wade was coming up as it was observed last week. And we were talking about this pain-capable unborn child protection act. One of its authors, Hadley Arkus, regular guest here on Issues, etc. This thing's been around for a while. And finally, with a new Republican-controlled Congress sitting down and beginning their duties, we thought, and so did Carol, we thought, here's the time when Congress is going to be able to at least pass this through Congress, and it will at least make it to the president's desk for his veto. That's all the farther it would go. But Congress seemed pretty ready to do this. It was on the schedule. And then, at the last minute, literally the last minute, I think on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, they pulled it. They put in a substitute bill, kind of a sop for the pro-lifers there gathered in the hundreds of thousands in Washington, D.C. But this pain-capable Unborn Child Protection Act that would have banned abortions at 20 weeks and after, well, it just kind of disappeared. How did that happen? Joining us to talk about that issue and also a New York Times editorial on the Supreme Court and same-sex marriage and the HBO series Girls, Molly Ziegler-Hemingway, a senior editor at The Federalist and a regular guest here on Issues, Etc. Molly, welcome.
It's great to be here with you.
I like the way you put this. You say, it takes a special combination of incompetence and cowardice to miss an easy layup like this, but apparently the new Republican Congress has it in spades. What do you mean by that?
Well, this late-term abortion ban is something that is viewed very favorably by a majority of Americans. You know, abortion is a very contentious topic, but this is one issue on which Americans are pretty unified. They really don't like late-term abortion. We're one of very few countries that permit this, and two of the others are North Korea and China, so we're not in good company here. So this is something that should have been easy to pass. It's been passed before by the Republicans in the House, and at the last minute there was squabbling and bickering over one of the provisions in the bill, and they ended up losing. It was such a fight that they ended up having to pull this bill, even though they had promised pro-lifers that they would pass it on the 42nd anniversary of the Roe v. Wade legislation. And it was just embarrassing. It was bad all around.
You know, this was going to be one of those. And I mean, I'm not trying to demean the bill or the intentions of those who wanted to pass it. It was going to be, practically speaking, one of these big symbolic gestures that would put something like this on President Obama's desk and force him to veto it force him to veto it. And it seemed a win-win. It seemed, you know, you can vote for this thing. Even if your heart wasn't in it, it wasn't going to pass, but you could vote for it and at least get the symbolic gesture out of it. What's going on?
Well, it's not just symbolic in that a lot of states follow the lead of the Congress here in how they write this legislation and how they pass it. The fighting all came down to a provision that was in the bill the last time around, too, that you actually could have a late-term abortion if you'd been raped, which is kind of odd to begin with, but to keep it from being just a big loophole that you could drive a Mack truck through, they said that if you were going to claim rape as the reason for the late-term abortion, that you would have to have reported it. And so some people felt like that was rude or would just be a political loser. Now, what's interesting about it is that same provision was in the bill 2 years ago, and it wasn't a political loser for pro-lifers, far from it, because in order to fight this rape exception or reporting requirement, you have to defend late-term abortion. And nobody wants to defend late-term abortion. I mean, it basically is a way of telling constituents, I'm a monster. You know, I think I've put infanticide. So it was not a political loser. But for some reason, people were concerned about it. And that's what got the fights going, apparently. And it ended up that the entire bill was scuttled. I mean, they do say they're going to vote on it. But since it didn't matter in the long run. It wasn't going to be passed anyway. The symbolism of it was important. And again, there are a few issues that play so well in the media on the abortion topic for pro-lifers, since so many people in the media tend to be apologists for abortion rights.
You were in D.C. for the March for Life on the 42nd anniversary?
I was.
What was the reaction when news about this kind of began to filter around, that the big thing that was supposed to happen there in the House didn't happen?
Well, certainly pro-lifers were outraged by this. Again, they had been looking forward to this for quite some time. They knew this was an important bill to pass. They liked the symbolic nature of it passing on the 42nd anniversary, and they were very disappointed and outraged. Now, having said that, it didn't ruin for pro-lifers what has become a very important pilgrimage, annual pilgrimage, to the nation's capital, and they still had a very important and good time commiserating with each other as they continue to battle to defend and protect unborn life.
Why, coming back to that reporting requirement with the rape exception, why is that so important? Why is it important that that if some form of that required, as sensitive as it may be, needs to be in a bill like this?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there are legitimate disagreements on that provision. What's interesting about it, though, is that the only other ban that's similar to this that was passed by Congress is the partial birth abortion ban, and that doesn't have a rape exception. We don't say, oh, you can have a partial birth abortion if you've been raped. And a lot of people wondered why you would say, oh, you can have a, you can abort this baby at 9 months so long as you've been raped. There are people who think that it's important to have a rape exception in pro-life legislation, but people who support permitting abortion in cases of rape usually don't extend that the full 9 months of the pregnancy. It's something that they think, maybe early on in the pregnancy is one thing. Later, when the child is capable of pain and whatnot, it's a harder thing to defend. But, how you pass these bills is important. It's just, and you should be sensitive to the political ramifications of them. But in this case, we actually had 2 years of evidence that the way this plays politically is definitely in favor of pro-lifers and to the detriment of people who support late-term abortion, such as Cory Gardner's opponent in Colorado. He defeated Mark Udall. And Joni Ernst defeated her opponent in part with help on this issue.
What other lessons ought we to learn, sad lessons, about the GOP majority, at least at this point in this Congress, based upon their failure to have the political will to get this late-term abortion ban passed
in the House? Yeah, I would say, no, it was definitely a wake-up call to people, regardless of whether they care about the abortion issue or not. The public relations skills going on there couldn't be worse. I mean, the headlines coming out of this very popular bill that the majority of the country supports was, oh, women in the GOP are freaked out by this bill, and GOP women reject abortion bill is too extreme. I mean, that's a public relations disaster, and it didn't need to happen. And that speaks to the other issue, which is that it doesn't appear that leadership has a good strategy for moving forward on legislation. This was an easy bill, and if they can't pass an easy bill like this, what's going to happen when they actually have to pass a bill that might be more difficult or less popular among Americans? So I think it's a wake-up call for people that things better change if the Republicans want to have a more successful time in leadership.
What does it tell you, if anything, or what does it suggest to you, if anything, about a Republican stance going into the 2016 elections?
I don't know about that, actually. I don't know if it can really tell us that much. I think that, it was a good wake-up call early in the legislature so that they can hopefully figure out what's going wrong if they want to do better. Being pro-life is still very popular in this country, and despite what you hear in the media, it's a good way to win elections. And it was certainly important for Republican candidates and a few pro-life Democrats in this last go-around to emphasize that they do support protection for unborn life. I don't imagine that's going to go away. This debate will continue for the foreseeable future, but hopefully people will get their messaging a little bit better.
Before we leave that subject behind, what were some of the highlights from last week's LCMS Life Conference that was held in conjunction with the March for Life there in Washington, D.C.?
Well, President Harrison actually came along with, I believe, 5 or 6 district presidents, which was great. And President Harrison gave a speech on the doctrine of the two kingdoms, on the teaching of the two kingdoms, I should say, and how Lutherans understand the different roles for church and state. And that was quite well received by the crowd. Professor Robbie George came and spoke on some of the philosophical underpinnings of the pro-life movement. Lila Grace Rose was there talking about some of her work investigating abortion clinics. Carol Tobias also spoke. It was just all around a wonderful conference that if people are pro-life, they should look into attending the next one.
I got to mention, mutual friend and regular guest here on the program, Maggie Carner, was singled out for some very special and much needed recognition. What form did that take at the Life Conference?
Well, that was definitely the highlight of the conference on Saturday night. This was a surprise, but the Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne bestowed upon Maggie Carner an honorary doctorate for her teaching on life and her witness to the church on these topics. She has been a bold defender of the sanctity of human life from conception to natural death, and her writings and public pronouncements on this have been of such a service, not just to the church, but to the country as a whole.
I mean, not to mention the fact that she is suffering with what is, you know, at least as far as we can tell, humanly speaking, a terminal brain cancer, and has been very bold in talking about end-of-life issues, too, hasn't she?
Yes, in the last year, Brittany Maynard, who had the same type of brain cancer, killed herself because I can't actually describe why she did it, but it was something that in pop culture was very much talked about, and Dr. Maggie Carner spoke about how she had that same type of brain cancer and she would not be killing herself, and explained why she does not believe that's right. And it was it was a very popular piece that she wrote. She's also recorded interviews talking about the same thing that were very important at a time when the country was finding the other argument so intriguing.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll turn to another subject with Molly Ziegler-Hemingway, senior editor at The Federalist. She's written recently on a New York Times editorial that is making an old argument for the New York Times. The Supreme Court just makes a decision on a certain subject, then the debate over that subject will end. The subject this time is same-sex marriage. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is a regular guest. When we come back, we're going to talk more with her about that and about the HBO series Girls. By the way, you'll find a link to Molly's columns at The Federalist at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Messiah Lutheran, Seattle, Washington. Grace Lutheran, McPherson, Kansas. St. Paul's Lutheran, Bridgeport, Nebraska. Our Savior Lutheran, Raleigh, North Carolina. St. Paul Lutheran, Hancock, Maryland. Messiah Lutheran, Keller, Texas. St. John's Lutheran, Maple Grove, Minnesota. Grace Lutheran, Parker, Colorado. And Our Redeemer Lutheran, Harrington, Kansas. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, and click support. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Classical Education 101. The principles of classical education are time-tested teaching methods used in select public, private, and charter schools across the country and fast becoming the preferred method for all parents. What about classical Lutheran education? What are these time-tested methods? Come to St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois on Saturday, January 31st at 9 a.m. For more information, call 618-633-2209.
How does confessional Lutheran theology measure up against popular yet false worldviews, ideas, and religions? Find out at the San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, Friday, February 6th and Saturday, February 7th at Faith Lutheran Church in San Antonio, Texas. Meet and hear regular guests Chris Rosebro, Dr. Joel Heck, and others at the San Antonio Biblical Worldview Conference, February 6th and 7th in San Antonio. flc-sa.org, flc-sa.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is our guest. She's senior editor at The Federalist. I'm Todd Wilkin. Molly, another thing that you've written about recently is kind of the peculiar wishful thinking of the Times editorial staff, especially an editorial recently published on the Supreme Court and same-sex marriage. What did you find there?
Yeah, well, the Supreme Court has agreed to take up some cases dealing with same-sex marriage. And the New York Times said, oh, finally, you know, they're going to follow the logic and they are going to end the debate once and for all on this topic. And it just cracks me up because the day after Roe v. Wade was handed down, the New York Times had a front page news story calling it a historic resolution of a fiercely controversial issue. When, in fact, I think it was when Roe v. Wade came down that you could almost say the pro-life movement really began in earnest. I mean, there were certainly people fighting the fight before then, but that's when it became a much more popular cause, when people realized that the court had handed down this decision. Likewise, however much people may wish that the issue of same-sex marriage and all the implications of same-sex marriage would be resolved once the court hands down a decision, it is insane to think that that would happen, you know, given everything we know about how important this issue is to competing sides.
Now, is the New York Times probably correct in their hope, not our hope, but their hope, that the Supreme Court is going to redefine marriage in some sort of codified way?
I think clearly the Supreme Court has been moving toward redefining marriage, and all of the warnings that people have put out there about the way that they have made previous rulings makes it seemingly probable that they will, in fact, redefine marriage. I mean, you never know with this court what they're going to do, and they have also expressed an interest in having as narrow rulings as possible. So it's possible that they will just have a narrow ruling that doesn't completely redefine marriage nationally. But of course, it's also possible that they will. So yeah, I think they're probably on the right page in terms of where their hopes are. But again, people haven't even begun thinking deeply about this issue. They don't even know how to think about the issue. They haven't even started to comprehend all the things, all the ramifications of redefining marriage. The idea that this would settle the issue for once and for all is a pipe dream.
Now, how much of this do you think, and this is, I'm just asking for your opinion, how much of this is just kind of the New York Times knowing who their readers are? It's no secret, although it's a national newspaper, it's no secret that the New York mentality is very insular, that it's like, I don't know anybody who's pro-life. I mean, I've been to 1,000 cocktail parties this year, and I've never met a pro-lifer before. Is that part of what's going on here?
I actually think that's a major part of what's going on. They have convinced themselves that the caricatures they have made of arguments against redefining marriage are all that's out there, when in fact the caricatures that they've invented have nothing to do with the actual concerns and criticisms people have about redefining marriage. So they haven't even encountered these arguments because they are afraid to, or otherwise I'm not sure why they're not doing it. And so they have utterly convinced themselves that there's nothing out there. And of course, if there was no reasonable reason to be against redefining marriage, well, then the issue would go away once the Supreme Court ruled on it. In their minds, it's just that they're going to be very surprised when they find out that there are millions upon millions of people who have very thoughtful, reasoned beliefs that contradict the New York Times editorial page.
So are you saying that just as Roe v. Wade in many ways gave birth to the full-blown kind of sophisticated pro-life movement that persists and grows even to this day, 42 years later, that a decision on the part of the Supreme Court to redefine marriage as something other than a man and a woman could well give birth to a similar movement, long-lived movement, a pro-marriage movement?
Yeah, I absolutely think that's a very strong possibility. And what's interesting about this is actually in ways that are very similar to abortion, this is a complicated topic. You know, we tend to look at these things as very cut and dry, whether you're pro-life or pro-choice or pro-redefining marriage or against it, we say, well, it's obvious what your answer is going to be. But in both cases, these are very complicated issues. And the way that we approach them, it has all these implications for different issues as well. So I see a lot of similarities in the abortion topic and the same-sex marriage topic. And likewise, I think that if there were a major ruling like Roe v. Wade that was so radical, that you would also see the birth of a movement built around sexual complementarity and its importance in human relationships.
It's called girls. It's called girls. It's called girls. It's called girls.
Molly, I've known you and your husband Mark for years now, and you longer than Mark, but I'm picturing you and Mark sitting around watching Lena Dunham and her now famous HBO Girls program, and you've written recently a set of kind of viewers' notes, conversation about this very popular show that in many ways kind of, what do you say, it at least exposes the poverty of the postmodern morality in a very accurate way. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I would first of all say Girls is not popular in terms of the national audience, but it's incredibly popular among progressives in media and politics. And Lena Dunham, who writes the show, is considered sort of the patron saint of the progressive millennial female. So she's the voice of her generation, we're always told in all of these profiles. So she has a show about the sexual lives, basically, of four girls in New York City. And you would think at first blush that it's advocating for this sexualityism, this sex in whichever way people want to have it, you know, no judgment type thing. But in showing the absolute devastation of these girls' lives, it actually becomes what I think is the most conservative show on television. It's such a cautionary tale against adopting the modern sexual ethos of consent being the only issue that matters in sexual relationships.
So while attempting to promote that kind of lifestyle, it is telling the truth about it.
Yeah, and I actually think whatever you want to say about Lena Dunham, and there's a lot you could say against her, she is she's someone who understands that a story must be told with an eye toward some honesty. You know, she obviously has trouble with honesty in general, but her stories ring true. I mean, if she's telling about a character who makes bad decisions, she will show the full effect of those bad decisions.
So you and your husband sit and watch this, binge watch, I assume?
Well, we watched the first season, and we actually thought it was pretty good. So then we decided to watch the rest of it, but we were very behind. So we binge watched seasons 2, 3, and now we're into 4. And I would not recommend it to anyone. It was very difficult. The first season wasn't bad. The second and third seasons were horrible. But now we're so committed that we are continuing to watch it. And you all might want to pray for my husband because he is finding it very difficult. So.
Okay. That's what I was curious about. And that is both of you are young, hip urbanites. I hope I don't insult you by saying that, but you are. And you're watching this, though, as people who have very distinct Christian values, and you're watching this. I'm curious about your reactions vis-a-vis your husband's reactions.
Well, I mean, I don't know. We kind of have felt that this is something that we should do, because if the only people who are talking about these really important cultural artistic expressions are people with the wrong worldviews, then they control the entire discussion, and there's no way to tap into that conversation and show a different way of looking at things. So I wouldn't recommend it for everybody, and it is even at times challenging for us, but we do think this is important for us to watch and be part of the cultural conversation so that we can point to a different way of thinking and understanding things. But, you know, for instance, even just one of the things that people joke about with girls is that Lena Dunham, who's not conventionally attractive and seems to go out of her way to be even less conventionally attractive than she is naturally, is naked in half of the episodes. That's not, you know, that's a challenge to watch for someone with a different worldview.
Finally, with about 30 seconds, what does the show, at least from your perspective, having watched most of it, what does it tell you about progressive feminism? About 30 seconds here, Molly.
Well, that's what I find so fascinating about the show. It just shows the complete and utter failure of progressive feminism. You have four characters, each and every one of whom is desperately sad, miserably sad, yearning for real love and relationship and connection with other people, and has no roadmap for how to figure it out. I feel, you know, it's just an indictment of our culture that we have permitted such devastation in the sexual landscape and such confusion, and it's a wake-up call.
Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is the senior editor at The Federalist. Folks, I encourage you to bookmark The Federalist in your browser and visit it often. There's a lot of great stuff there. We'll have a link to Molly's articles at The Federalist at our website, issue ztc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Molly, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Folks, it's essential in our 21st century post-Christian culture that we have thinking Christians. Molly Ziegler-Hemingway is a great example of one of those, and that's why your high school age child or your grandchild should consider attending Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. You can find out more at blc.edu, blc.edu, or give them a call toll-free, 1-800-944-3066. That's 1-800-944-3066, blc.edu, Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. Look, we do have to have thinking Christians. We have to have Christians who have their ear to the ground in the culture to understand it, not to fear it, but to know exactly what we're dealing with, not only for the sake of being able to speak the gospel well and in an articulate way into that culture. That's important. And, you know, Christians are part of culture anyway, so it's not like we have to translate it into a foreign language. We speak the native language of the culture because we're just big fat sinners like everyone else, but also so that we might serve our neighbor in the midst of that culture. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
When you need a friend, you have a friend in Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd, and friends among his people at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, Arnold, Missouri. At Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, we offer Christ-centered word and sacrament ministry, inspirational liturgical worship services, and faithful preaching and teaching. Sunday worship services are at 9 a.m. Sunday school and Bible class are at 10:30. We also have an excellent Christian preschool. We invite you to join us. Good Shepherd Lutheran Church, 2211 Tenbrook Road, Arnold, Missouri, 636-296-1292.
Have you recently graduated from high school or college and are still making up your mind about your future career? Here's an opportunity to serve your neighbor through an extended, uniquely Lutheran service program. It's called the Lutheran Youth Corps. Find out more about the Lutheran Youth Corps at lcms.org/youthcorps. Life together through witness and mercy, the Lutheran Youth Corps. lcms.org/youthcorps.